Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. Sending in for Andrew Tuck this week, I'm Carlotta Ribello. Coming up on today's program.
Sand is to cities sort of what flour is to cakes. You know, it's the invisible but absolutely essential raw material that actually forms the bulk, the structure of cities themselves.
What are our cities made of? From concrete to timber, glass and steel, there are many facets that make up a city, but are all of them as obvious as they sound? This week, we peek inside our built environment and discuss the very action of city building, from sand to circular construction, and even a dip into the immaterial world too. Find out more over the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Carlotta Ribello. We start today with one of the materials we use most in our cities, sand. After water and air, sand is in fact the natural resource the world consumes the most of, and it's used for a variety of construction purposes. From concrete walls to glass windows, sand is all around our built environment. But getting it isn't as easy as you might think, and we are running out of it too. Vince Beiser is the author of the fascinating book The World in a Grain, which explores the story of sand, as well the people who mine it, sell it, and even kill for it. Vince joined Andrew Tuck down the line a little earlier, and Andrew began by asking why sand is so important to our cities.
The thing is, sand, even though it seems like the most trivial thing in the world, barely anybody ever thinks about it, but it's actually literally the substance that our cities are made of. It's the raw material that modern cities are literally built out of. And what I mean by that is you can see it if you just look around. I mean, wherever you're sitting now, wherever folks listening to this are sitting, chances are excellent that the floor underneath you, the walls around you, the roof over your head are made out of concrete. Right? Just like pretty much every modern building in the world, anywhere in the world, is made out of concrete. And what's concrete? Concrete is just sand and gravel that's been glued together, right? So every building, every shopping mall, every office tower that you see is just a huge pile of sand. All the roads that connect all those buildings, every highway, every roadway, every sidewalk, they're also made of concrete or asphalt, which are, again, just sand that's been glued together. And it doesn't even stop there. Every piece of glass, every window in every one of those buildings, and every window in every one of those cars going up and down those roads is also made from sand. Glass is just sand that's been melted down. So in other words, sand is to cities sort of what flour is to cakes. You know, it's the invisible but absolutely essential raw material that actually forms the bulk, the structure of cities themselves.
Now, when you put it like that, that's a lot of sand by anyone's reckoning. Where do we get all this sand from?
Yeah, so this is where it starts to become a problem. The first thing to know is it's an enormous amount of sand that we use every year. Sand is actually the natural resource that we consume the most of, next to water. More than oil, more than wheat, more than rice, anything you can name. Sand is the most consumed solid natural resource on the planet. We use about 50 billion tons of it every single year, which is enough to cover the entire nation of Germany every year. So, excellent question is, where do we get that from? The answer is we get it from lots of places. We get it from riverbeds, from the bottoms of lakes. We get it from quarries on land. Some of it is stripped literally off of beaches. Some of it comes from the bottom of the ocean. And the thing is, of course, there's a lot of sand in the world, but when you're talking about any substance that you're using that much of, you're going to run into problems. And in fact, we are causing enormous environmental damage all over the world with the amount of sand that we're using. And in some places, there's so much demand for it that a black market has sprung up and organized crime has gotten into the game. People are actually being murdered over sand.
In what sorts of places is that kind of criminality feeding into the demand for sand? Is this in places where there's a huge explosion of urbanization going on?
Yeah, basically, which is pretty much everywhere in the developing world, right? Cities are growing at a pace and on a scale that is way beyond anything in human history right now, right? Especially in the developing world, in China, India, Indonesia, Nigeria, you name it, people are pouring out of the countryside and into cities, which is the main reason why we are using such incredible amounts of sand. So in a lot of those countries, where there's huge sudden demand for sand and not really the best legal systems, the best regulatory systems, a lot of corruption in the system, you get a lot of corruption, you get a lot of crime. So there's illegal sand mining, black market sand mining going on in dozens and dozens of countries around the world. There's been violence connected with it in at least a dozen countries around the world that I know of. Definitely hundreds of people have been murdered just in the last few years. And that's mainly India is probably the place where the violence is at its worst, but also people have been killed in Nigeria, in Sierra Leone, in Kenya, in Indonesia, in Mexico, in a number of countries around the world. There's been deaths and many more where there's been, you know, beatings, kidnappings, assaults, threats, all that kind of stuff.
Now, tell me, if I'm a property developer sitting, for example, in the Gulf or in Saudi Arabia or in North Africa, does that mean I'm in a better position in the sense that, you know, you have deserts on your doorsteps that can provide huge amounts of sand?
Yeah, the problem is there's a lot of sand in the world's deserts, of course, but it's pretty much useless to us. And the reason is the sand that you find in deserts, the grains are just the wrong shape for making concrete, concrete being the number one thing that we use sand for. We use it for lots of things, like I said, glass and computer chips and many other things, but we use more sand for concrete than all those other things put together. And desert sand doesn't work for concrete. The reason is because it's been eroded by wind over thousands and millions of years, and that's made those grains kind of rounded and smooth. Whereas the sand that's been eroded by water that you find on riverbeds and on beaches, places like that, it's more angular. It's got more corners and sharp edges. So it locks together to form a solid structure, which of course you need for concrete. So it's like the difference between trying to build something out of a pile of little marbles as opposed to a big pile of little bricks. So all that desert sand, sadly, is pretty much useless to us.
Now, the concrete industry is one that is under a lot of pressure. People are beginning to see how environmentally needy and potentially damaging some of it can be. Many of the big players are trying to look at how they reduce even the quantity of water that they use in their manufacturing, and sand is certainly part of that debate. So are these companies beginning to look for some alternative to kind of stripping sand, as you say, from riverbeds and from quarries?
A little bit, but not very much at this point. You know, you're absolutely right. The industry's come under a lot of fire, especially for their carbon emissions, and they're starting very slowly to make some changes around that. But sand is still something that's just not on the radar for most people. Most people, including many people in the construction industry, just don't even realize that it's a problem. Because you got to realize a lot of it, you know, if you're a contractor building a hotel or a shopping mall complex or something like that, the sand that you're getting for your concrete probably has passed through several hands before it gets to you. Somebody's gone and dug it out of the local riverbed and then sold it to a wholesaler who's maybe sold it to another middleman. So by the time it gets to the job site, you don't even know if you even care to ask. It can be difficult to even know where it came from. So the impacts of what's happening, you know, in terms of the rivers that are damaged, in terms of forests and fields that have been ripped up to get at sand, that tends to happen at a real remove from those contractors. It's kind of similar in some ways to the issue of conflict minerals, you know, which you've probably heard about, you know, the fact that our cell phones and other electronic gadgets rely on metals like cobalt, which come from places like Congo, where they're often mined in really terrible conditions. But by the time that cobalt gets to Apple or IBM or whoever, it's passed through so many hands, it's hard to tell where it even came from.
Does that mean that there is kind of no way out of our dependency on sand at this time?
No, I don't think so. Well, first of all, the solution isn't to say we should be using less sand. We should figure out a way to get rid of sand. I mean, concrete is a great building material, right? There's really no alternative to it in a world where 8 billion people need housing and places to live and places to work and places to shop and roads to drive on. It's hard to imagine what else could work besides concrete, which means sand. But there are definitely things that we can do to make sure that the sand we're getting it in a way that's more sustainable, that isn't so destructive. And so part of that is just implementing better practices like we do with a lot of raw materials around the world. There are different oversight schemes, even like consumer-oriented schemes, like, you know, you've probably seen dolphin-safe tuna in your local grocery store or the Forest Stewardship Council, which sort of gives a stamp of approval to say that the wood that you're using for your construction project came from a sustainably maintained and harvested forest. We should really have something similar going on with sand. I think that would curb some of the worst excesses. But at the end of the day, if I can go big picture here for a minute, to my mind, the answer to the question of what can we do about sand, we sort of need to reframe the question because it's a very familiar question, right? We know that we're taking too many fish out of the ocean. We know we're cutting down too many trees all over the world. We know we're burning too much fossil fuel. And now we know that we're using too much sand. To my mind, these are not separate questions. They're all symptoms of the same problem, which is just overconsumption, meaning that the way that we live our lives and that we build our cities, which is where most people live, just can't continue in a world with almost 8 billion people. We've got to find ways to build our cities where most of us live in ways that are more sustainable, in ways that consume not just less sand, but less of everything.
Vince Beiser, the author of The World in a Grain There, speaking to the urbanist Sandra Tuck. As we just heard, sand is one of the crucial elements of how we build in our cities. But how can we make construction a more sustainable practice? Well, that's where circular construction comes in. The practice is all about trying to make the best use of the built environment, whether that's using the existing buildings as intensively as possible to trying to retain existing buildings and transform them to meet new needs, rather than knocking them down and starting afresh. Andrea Charlson is the built environment lead at Circuit, an EU-funded collaborative project between the cities of London, Hamburg, Copenhagen and Vantaa in Finland. Through Circuit, the four cities work together to increase the uptake of circular construction across them, sharing knowledge and also techniques. Andrea joined Monocle's Tom Edwards, and Tom began by asking her about some of the ways cities can capitalise and best utilise already existing infrastructure.
We've got a lot of buildings that are underutilized either because they're lying empty and haven't been refurbished, but also this idea that lots of buildings are used maybe part of the day or part of the week. And if we could utilize more of our structures, you know, for more of the clock, actually wouldn't need to build as much in the future. And so that's the idea of maximize the capacity of what we've already got from a use perspective. And then if there's things that are empty, trying to refurbish them and transform them first before we start to consider demolishing them.
Is it really instructive to look at real world examples of, yeah, these principles of circular construction in practice? I guess it's really important, right, to take it away from being something that's discussed in the abstract, being something that people can really grasp, whether they're in development or city planning or just private individuals.
Yeah, exactly. And one recent really, you know, exciting example is it's within London, and it's a development that's been done by British Land, and they were supported by Arup and Lendlease. It's called One Triton Square, and this was an existing building, and it was an existing office building. It was due for a refresh, and rather than knocking it down, the first approach was, well, how can we retain and reuse the existing building? The existing building wasn't that old, and it had been designed for this idea that it could be transformed in the future into its initial design, which is kind of why that other part of circularity is so important. And so through the process, they retained the existing building. They did some strengthening and added new floors, and they managed to create twice as much office space on the same site, but without demolishing the existing building. So that's kind of one example of the circularity. But then also coming down like more specifically, they also removed and refurbished and reconditioned the facade and then re-put that back on the building as well. And as well as this being like a great example of circularity, the project team have also said it's like a 43% cost saving based on like a rebuild scenario. And they say 40,000 tons of carbon, and actually it was quicker. It's kind of a real success story all round. Like financially it worked, and environmentally it worked, and program wise it worked. And now it's in use and it's really successful as a building as well.
The project you've described, it comes in quicker, it's cheaper, it's better, it reuses. My question to you is, why aren't all projects then governed by these considerations? Is it about people who just aren't aware of that reality? Are they dragging their feet for other reasons? Are there other stakeholders maybe who need to do more to broadcast these kinds of accomplishments?
Yeah, I mean, it's a complicated problem, and it's something that we are actually trying to explore further in the Circuit project. What is the whole life value and business case of these kind of projects. I think particularly when it comes to the redevelopment and transformation question, it can often be kind of what you're comparing it against, because if you could get significantly more area by starting afresh, then that is going to skew the financial argument against being able to refurbish the existing structure, and you'll be able to add probably a smaller amount because of the existing capacity of that structure than if you just started afresh. So that's one consideration. And then the other consideration is that, I mean, the example I cited is really great and it worked, but it can be perceived to be slower because different things will take different amounts of time. It's very different from a normal construction process to do this refurbishment and the reuse. So they actually created a pop-up factory to recondition the facades, which is a very different way of procuring and constructing from just buying a facade from the manufacturer who would do their normal processes. So it's not as easy yet to do these things than it is to do what we normally do. So we do need clients who are interested. We need the policy to support these ideas. And yeah, the whole supply chain needs that kind of upskilling, which is one of the things Circuit's trying to address.
Let me ask you a bit about the big picture here. You know, we've got these targets, ambitious goals, making London, you know, a zero carbon city by the middle of the century and so on. And obviously this has been thrown into ever sharper focus because of COP26 and just the sheer urgency of the dialogue around the sustainable agenda. Do you think that the work that you're doing, what you've already been talking to us about, Andrea, does that help? Can it contribute very directly to making London a net zero city by 2050? Or are there too many other complicating factors to say that, yes, this helps to achieve that?
Everything that we're trying to promote through circular construction definitely does reduce carbon emissions. The tricky thing when you're talking about a net zero city is what you're counting as your net. So London's targets will be around the emissions that originate in London. Most of the emissions that I'm describing that we're reducing through circular construction would normally happen outside of London, because manufacturing of most construction products and materials is not within a London boundary. So in that respect, it's not part of like a city's usual net zero target, but it enables us to continue developing and also be not putting the burden on other places and other cities. So it's definitely helping us transition to like a net zero carbon world in totality, though it wouldn't necessarily be reflected in a city's kind of normal balance sheet. We talk a lot at ReLondon about consumption-based carbon emissions. So those emissions associated with what London needs to live and work, rather than just those emissions that have originated within our geographical boundary. And that's what we're trying to reduce through these circular economy ideas.
To what degree is this whole discussion informed by the need to change or challenge people's, you know, those of us who live in big cities around the world, their very nature of their relationship with what's around them, with the built environment? Is that too ambitious? Is that unhelpful to ask that question? Or is that a necessary part of looking at how we make the kinds of changes you're talking about circular construction? We need people to challenge the way they engage in and live within their cities on that almost very sort of fundamental level.
Yeah, and it's all about people, isn't it, in the end? And whether it's the people who are designing, constructing the built environment and the rest of us who use it. It is quite interesting because we do feel, I think, quite detached maybe from all of those decisions that happen. So it's about being able to empower people to use the built environment in a different way, giving people enough information to ask the right questions, even when it's something like in our own homes, if we need some DIY work done or, you know, extensions and things like that. Making sure people are aware of what they could be asking for and how they might ask for them is probably like the first steps on that journey to a more broader understanding of these issues.
Let me just ask you then, we're talking about things there in that last question very much in the abstract, but you've already given us lots of real world examples in London where progress is being made. How is that facilitated or enabled or supported by the processes that all these projects need to go through, be that planning and permissions and so on? Is it an environment that's very conducive to making the kinds of innovations that you're talking about?
Yeah, actually, London is kind of leading the way on these kind of planning policies to support circularity. In the new London plan, which was enforced earlier this year, there is now a policy that requires circularity to be considered at the very earliest parts of a scheme's design, like before a planning permission is granted. And that's really important for getting these ideas like built in to the whole process rather than they're trying to be kind of added on at the end. And that's when they do tend to kind of cost more or start to take longer if they're not fully integrated. So it's early days for that policy, but I think it's a really progressive way to push these decisions at an early stage.
Andrea Charlson from Circuit there in conversation with Monocle's Tom Edwards. From the physical parts of our cities to the more intangible. Data is perhaps one of the most important facets that make up the fabric of our built environment. So, is data becoming a building material for urban areas? And how can we best plan to build smart cities? Aruj Haider is the Chief Digital and Innovation Officer at Westminster City Council. She's at the helm of the council's strategy to better utilise data and bring communities together through smart innovation. For Aruj, it was crucial to bring a more human-centred design approach to the role as a way to use data as a driving force for residents and businesses alike. And I'm pleased to say that she joins me now. Aruj, thank you for joining us on The Urbanist today. Well, we are looking at how data has become as an important building block for cities as concrete and timber. How have you seen the role of data in our cities change over the last decade or so?
Data is just so crucial. I think for me, it's more than the building blocks. You know, I talk about it as our operating system. So kind of like, you know, if you imagine your phone, you've got an iOS, the operating system, and then everything else you do on top of it feeds into and takes the feed from the operating system. So without that, we can't do anything. And for me, that is how important data has become in the context of cities. Having said that, I still think that as a sector, we are quite, you know, immature in how we are using data. But increasingly, I think, you know, we have understood that it is not about just creating dashboards after dashboards. It's actually about doing something meaningful with it. And, you know, we've seen, you know, modern progressive councils like Camden, who've got this sort of open data trust, to, let's say, Barking and Dagenham, where they've got this sort of index that is around prosperity, to the work that the GLA is doing around data. And that really shines a light on the importance of how data has also evolved and how the use of it has evolved. So for us as a council, we are trying to move away from just looking at dashboards. That's okay, but that doesn't give you anything meaningful. It's just pretty dashboards that somebody creates and then you see it for a month and then you forget about it, to how we can use that data to make decisions in the future. So a couple of projects we are exploring at the moment. One of them is around footfall, and I can definitely talk about this in the context of the pandemic as well. But for now, it's really about understanding the footfall in a certain area. Because, for example, we know that our high streets have taken a hit in terms of visitor numbers. What other, you know, data sets have we got? You know, whether it's weather, you know, whether it's images from Google Earth, bring it together. And could we give that information to market stallholders who can then use that to understand how much stock they should be purchasing? And that's the power of data. Similarly, we've seen how COVID has impacted on different communities. You know, for example, people weren't able to meet each other physically. So what does that mean for the elderly and the vulnerable? And this is where we have really taken the time to understand what does it mean to be digitally excluded? And then think about, you know, that data to give interventions that are very targeted and personalized instead of a one size fits all.
Well, that aspect of digital exclusion that you just mentioned was one of the main threads and narratives around COVID, when, you know, we're so used to having our vaccine certificates on our phones, or when we had, you know, to scan with a phone to get access to some venues. And of course, not everyone has access to that. And it ties in quite nicely with this program that you've launched, which is Smart Cities for All. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
You know, when we started off on our journey on smart cities, you know, we were exploring multiple projects. So, you know, predominantly infrastructure and technology related. We weren't really clear at that time what a smart city meant to us. So we looked across the world, you know, whether it was Barcelona, very citizen-centric city, to, let's say, Dubai, which is very much about technology first as well. And then we looked at our mission, you know, as local government, as a public sector body. We talk about being a city for all. And we said, you know what, smart is not a thing on its own. It cannot be. You know, we are there to create a city for all. And therefore, it's all about being a smart city for all. So that means that all of our programs have that real inclusion angle to it as well. But, you know, whether we are exploring a project in social care, or it's in children and young people, or housing and licensing, smart city, for all, means that we are starting off very much from a perspective of understanding the needs, working with the customers at the other end to co-create the solutions. So that's the angle we take on everything. We've got four themes under smart cities. So it's empowering people, so which is very much about how can we use technology and innovation to empower our communities, to get them to make the most of their lives. To a clean tech city, which is obviously pretty self-explanatory, but it's all about using tech to, you know, have cleaner and greener air. Then we talk about innovation ecosystems. And then finally, extraordinary experiences. So for those who live, work or visit in the city, how can we use smart to create that experience for them? Now, digital inclusion is a really interesting topic. In the past, we would have just gone with a number of interventions because we would have known that there is a problem, but without really understanding the scale of the problem and the source of the problem, we would have just launched a number of interventions. What we did instead was we used data. We did a survey, then we created a map, then we did some qualitative research, created a persona bank, and that has really allowed us to dig deeper on where those areas of exclusion are, for instance. But then through the face-to-face survey, we've understood the drivers of those exclusion. And then actually, it's really complicated. It's not as simple as just giving somebody a device. Mm-hmm. So, you know, somebody might be feeling lonely, for example. Somebody might not have the confidence to use the internet. You know, they might not trust it as well. So we've looked at all of those drivers individually. And then we've got targeted programs, whether it's through the use of digital ambassadors, so people that they trust within the community, through to, you know, the kinds of skills that we would put forward in terms of training. So we have really taken the time to understand. And for me, that is the power of a smart city for all. Take the time to understand the problem and personalize the interventions. And digital inclusion for us, that approach has been adopted, you know, pan-London through the work that we've done with the London Office of Technology and Innovation as well. But that's what a smart city means to me.
Do you feel that the pandemic in a certain way has accelerated this prioritization of data and of smart city technology? You know, it was already going to go on an upwards trajectory, but do you feel like the pandemic somehow made that process a bit quicker?
Absolutely. Pre-pandemic, we had just started, let's say, working on Teams. Not everybody was using it to have meetings internally, just as one end of the spectrum. Similarly, you know, elsewhere, externally with our communities, we were trying a few digital products and solutions, but it was really slow. But during the pandemic, we saw literally record-breaking time. So within 3 or 4 weeks, we created a digital solution to connect volunteers to the houses that needed food and so on and so forth. And that to me is amazing. You know, we can do it. It's the mindset and also it's the time, which is obviously post-pandemic. So I feel that it's really shown people the art of the possible in terms of making innovation happen, in terms of using technology in the right way. That's where, you know, going forward, we need to think about footfall, you know, visitor numbers, look at our problems, use data, and then bring in technology at record time in a similar way that we did during the pandemic. One thing that I will say is, although on one level it has highlighted the problem and it has also highlighted the art of the possible, on another level, I think if you're not careful, we're going to lose it. And for me, this really shows the importance of public sector right here, right now. We've got this opportunity to really take a lead. And I think the private sector can learn from us if we really do it well. But if you're not careful and if you don't move fast enough, we'll lose this opportunity. So for me, that's the thing that I'm trying to push in my organization. Public sector can be in the lead over here for a change. And I think it's definitely happened at the back of COVID.
I am quite curious then to hear your perspective. If with this conjuncture, we had COVID and an acceleration on the use of data, we have all the initiatives that Westminster City Council is putting forward. I'm curious, are there ways that cities use data that perhaps us residents have no idea about?
Yes. I mean, you know, as I said, that my previous role was non-tech. Mm-hmm. So for me, the last year has been a huge learning curve, you know, so exciting, but obviously full of challenges as well. You know, we collect all kinds of data. So whether it's your council tax, you know, whether you're, you know, applying for a parking permit, whether you're going to a library, you know, whether it's something to do which requires a little bit more trust, like, you know, children and young people data or the data in social care, you know, stuff that we collect as part of planning applications. I mean, it's incredible. I had no idea working on the culture side before. I had a sense, but all of that data is something that we collect as an organization. So I don't think people realize that. For us, if we really want to create an impact going forward, is that's where unlocking the power of data becomes extremely important. And we need to have more maturity as a sector. So how do we connect all these disparate sources of data, all that legacy information here and there that people don't really realize that, you know, on a day-to-day basis, we are collecting as well. So for me, that is where we need to connect the dots going forward. So for example, as a resident, why do you need to have multiple applications if you want to apply for a library or if you want a parking permit or, you know, if you want to register childcare vouchers, for example? Why can't we as a council curate all of that, bring it together? So as a resident, we just fill it once and we learn and we help you get better. Over here, though, there is one thing that I want to really highlight is the word trust. So we are not Big Brother. We are not that. However, we are collecting a lot of data. So for us, it's about using it in a smarter way. But for me, it's really important that we establish that trust with our citizens, which is why the co-creation is really, really important as well.
Do you feel that's a barrier that still exists, that lack of trust into, oh, what are they going to do with my data? I guess particularly when we were talking earlier about those residents who might not be as tech savvy, how do you go about breaking down that barrier and explaining, actually, this is something that will eventually empower the local community and be a benefit?
What's really interesting is that most people don't realize the amount of data that councils collect already. There's so much data that we collect as a council already. People don't realize it. But the second point for me is the only way we can create that trust is if you show them our intentions and if you're authentic and honest in our communication to them. That's really important. Typically, in the past, the way we have gone about projects is, you know, we've done them to people. You know, we haven't really listened. We haven't really understood what the problems are. I think if we show them, you know, and if we work with them together, they can understand then how we are going to be using the data. So, for example, if everybody's complaining about waste and clean streets, let's work together on validating that. What do we actually mean? We'll have some information sources, some data sets as well, but let's work with our communities to really get to the bottom of actually why does the problem exist. I think if we work on it together like that, we can then bring in our partners to help us with the solutions. And I think at that point, we create that trust because people know that we are doing it for the right intent. It's not because it's a vanity project by a council. It's not just something we are doing it without understanding the needs. It's a slow process. It doesn't happen overnight. However, it's just really about, you know, working with them, listening to them, showing them, you know, those quick wins as well as we are going along. But the trust can only be established once we've shown them, you know, how we have looked at their problems and solved them. And over time, they'll be more open about sharing the data. This also means that it's not going to be a one size fits all approach because everybody will be different. And that's where, you know, we can bring in some of that learning that, you know, we've had through digital inclusion work to understand who needs more help, who needs more support, and how can we get them to come on the journey with us in their time. And I suppose this is where, you know, one of the initiatives that we've launched is the Public Innovation Challenge. It's all about, you know, we don't want to do this to people. It's really important to me that, you know, our smart city approach and our program plan is actually driven by the communities. As part of it, we also want to show them the art of the possible. And that's where our partners will come in, like Google, Microsoft, etc. But I think that will be kind of like the first step in creating that trust.
Aruj Haider there from Westminster City Council. Thank you. And that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts for your weekly dose of urbanism, as well as our weekly sister show, Tall Stories, premiering every Monday. Today's episode was produced by myself and by David Stevens, and David also edited the show. And to play you out this week, here's Madonna with Material Girl. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.